Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This is Avi, and today we are going to be talking about emotional triggers, what they are, why they matter, and how to navigate them, and also why they are, in fact, precious gifts in disguise. My co-host today is my longtime friend, David Sauvage, who is a very gifted empath, meaning that he can feel the feelings of others and help all of us understand our feelings and therefore ourselves in a much deeper way.
I know what you guys are thinking, especially as you're looking at the title for this room and you're thinking, come on, Abhi, do you really think that triggers are gifts in disguise? And here's the thing. Yes, I actually do, or at least I do now. And David and I have done a few rooms over the past year on this topic of emotional triggers. And it's one that I really love talking about because every month, or even sometimes every week, this week was one such week, I realize what a big part of our lives these triggers are, whether we realize them or not. And I know that for many years, I just had absolutely no idea. So the more subtly I can feel things, I'm realizing that these triggers are a much bigger part of our lives, more than I even realized before. And usually when we had these conversations, we focused on really intense triggers and how to recognize them and navigate them. And that is really important. But I'm also realizing that these more subtle triggers that are happening so much more frequently have a significant impact. So I've just been surprised by their frequency. And I'm just wanting to see where that takes us, because I think it brings an unexpected element into this conversation. So that is the reason I wanted to talk about.
Awesome. I like the idea of getting into how triggers don't necessarily have to be big, explosive emotional experiences, but can be much subtler. And then also talking about how pervasive they are. But it feels right to start with some basic definitions and some basic groundwork for what we're talking about. The word trigger, I believe, was first used in a psychological or therapeutic context to mean something pretty specific. A trigger originally was a stimulus that brought up content from a trauma. So a stimulus that brings up something from a trauma. I believe it was used originally largely in the case of PTSD and specifically in the case of war veterans. So let's say you have gone away to war and you come home and all seems to be relatively well, but then an ambulance drives by your house and you are overcome with fear, or you completely freeze, or you run outside ready to defend your house. These are totally understandable reactions of a veteran to an ambulance, but they are not understandable reactions unless you have that context. So the ambulance in this case is serving as the trigger, which is bringing forth content or bringing forth an experience related to trauma. I like this definition, and that's pretty close to how I use it. But as the definition of trauma has expanded and expanded, so too has our understanding of trigger. I define a trigger as an emotional reaction that is seemingly disproportionate to the experience that caused it. So something relatively small happens or seemingly trivial, but your emotional reaction is intense. Or maybe something totally trivial happens and you have a little emotional reaction, but even that little emotional reaction doesn't make sense if all you're looking at is the situation at hand. So the reason we're having seemingly disproportionate reactions to stimuli is because they point to or are calling forth traumas from our past. So with a trigger, you seem like you're reacting to something that's happening right now, but you are actually reacting to something that has happened in the past. And your unconscious is projecting your past experience onto your current circumstance, which is then generating the emotional reaction that you're having. The trickiest thing about triggers is that most of us are not aware that this is what is happening. And so when something happens that brings up an intense emotional reaction, or maybe, per Avi's point, a subtle emotional reaction, but one that doesn't seem to make sense given the context, what we tend to do is generate a story that justifies the emotion we're having. So maybe somebody said something and a third party would have said, that's not that big a deal. He didn't even mean it. Why are you getting so angry? Rarely are we able to say, I'm getting so angry because when I was a child, my father used to talk to me in that same way. And I haven't fully processed my anger at the way my father talked to me. And so when this person talks to me in this similar way, I'm getting really angry at him, says almost nobody. But that would be where we would get to if we had a full and comprehensive understanding of ourselves, our triggers, and our traumas. Instead, what we do, totally understandably, totally naturally, is we generate a story that justifies why we're reacting like that. So somebody says something that is not that big a deal, I get really angry, and then I explain to myself and to any third party who's around, how could they do that? Why would they do that? What's wrong with them? They're trying to hurt me. And we have trouble seeing past our own story and into the underlying trauma that is giving rise to this story. What do you think, Avi? Do you think the way I'm talking about triggers here, laying a foundation for triggers, is good enough? Or do you think there needs to be more here at the outset?
I think that was beautiful. And I think the thing that might help is just a couple of different examples that we can use from different walks of life. Because the important thing that we wanted to reinforce today is the frequency of this without us realizing it. And it happens in seemingly trivial events to us every day. And a lot of us are not in touch with it. So I think there's so many ways that this can be helpful when we're talking about everyday examples of it.
I'll give a very small everyday example that's coming up for me right now. And that is that a mild trigger for me is when I feel slightly sick or under the weather, which is the case with me right now. So I have what I think feels to me like a mild cold. And in having this mild cold, there's an emotional reaction I have that does not seem to match it. And that reaction feels something like defeatism or maybe hopelessness. It's as if this mild cold is causing something in me to say, nobody cares about me. And I feel just a little bit alone. And despairing is harsh because it actually doesn't feel that intense. I have to really tune into it. I know that this is not the reaction that most people have when they have a cold. I know that this is specific to me. And I also know in this case where the trauma comes from, or at least I think I know where the trauma comes from, which is that when I was sick as a child and a couple of times when I went to the hospital, I did not feel supported. My parents weren't, in one or two cases, there for me the way I needed them. I know those are real traumas because they keep coming up again and again in the work that I'm doing. And so what I think is happening is when I get a little bit sick, it's triggering in me this feeling of despair rooted in my childhood where my parents weren't fully there when I was sick. Super subtle. And if I hadn't spent all these years navigating my own psychology, understanding traumas and triggers, I probably wouldn't even know what was going on. I would just say, oh, I don't feel good. And maybe if you were close friends with me and you were attuned, maybe you'd feel a whiff of sadness or something, but nothing extreme. What about you, Avi? Any triggers coming up in you to share?
Yeah, I guess an everyday trigger for me, sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it's not subtle, is when people are not punctual or late. So if someone's supposed to call me. If someone's late and we've had plans or I'm meeting a friend and they didn't let me know, I feel disrespected. And someone being late without giving me the heads up, or when I feel like, oh, they knew they should be here on time, really does things to me.
I'm curious if you might find another word other than disrespected. And I'm also curious what you mean by does things to me. What does arise for you?
I guess I feel dismissed. I feel not important. The person didn't think I was important enough.
Would it be like fair to say you feel angry?
I definitely feel angry. Sometimes it's more of a frustration, depends on the intensity of it. But it could be frustration all the way to anger. David and I have a friend that we used to work with and we used to travel with to the airport. And he would plan so that he could always be at the airport, literally at the exact moment that we needed to get up and get into the plane. There was no moment wasted. This was just his approach to life in general. And he had missed his flights before. And for us, and there was a lot that had gone into some of these work trips that we were doing together. So when he would be late at the airport, when he knew how important it was to me, then that would make me really angry. Versus if a friend is just late 10 minutes to a lunch and they didn't tell me, it's more annoying and frustrating. But the feeling is the same. The intensity goes up for me because of two things. One is if the expectations have been set and clarified and agreed to, and two, the stakes of the situation. But then I know you're going to talk about how these are stories, right?
So what we tend to do is we come up with a story, like I was saying, to justify our emotion. So when this same friend is late for me, because this guy definitely has a tendency to do what Avi described, I get mildly annoyed. I wouldn't say I get triggered. I don't feel that his lateness is bringing up some old trauma. I feel like I'm just reacting to what is happening in front of me. And when this guy was late to something that we were both involved in, I was mildly annoyed. And Avi was pacing back and forth. I hope you excuse this formulation. I rarely use it, but it feels like if ever there were a time to use it, it's now. You were pacing back and forth like a lunatic. Your head was swiveling around on your chest every which way. Your muscles were all tense. I think you were having trouble breathing. So your reaction was really strong to his being late, and I was mildly annoyed at him. Would you say that's fair?
Yes, I think that is fair. And as you were describing that, another thing just occurred to me, which is that, and I don't know if this is the case for everyone, but it's certainly the case with me, is it feels to me like repetition of triggers, the same trigger with the same person, intensifies it for me, the experience. So if this is a behavior that continues, I feel like the first time I get frustrated and then I might be able to talk to the person and then we clarify things or whatever, we have an exchange in terms of communication about it. And when the same thing occurs, I feel like the trigger continues to intensify for me.
I think that might be, you might have a couple of different triggers that are living together, which often happens too, which is this one trigger around punctuality. It's very important for you for people to be punctual. And then you have another trigger around people acting in a way that you experience to be disrespectful. And when somebody's doing it again and again, that disrespectful trigger is getting hit harder and harder. And then it gets even hit harder if you say to them, hey, I find this really disrespectful, and then they continue to do it. Now you're going to have a really hard time. Do you think I have that right?
Definitely.
I'll name a couple more triggers of mine. So we have some juicy examples. I'll name a relatively subtle one, and then I'll name a super intense, overwhelming one. So a subtle one happened to me the other day. I'm a part of this writing group. And I submitted a short story, first-person short story, nonfiction, true story, to this writing group. And there was a sentence in it that a woman in the writing group had a totally understandable negative reaction. And she said something like, "This sentence makes me not trust the narrator." And I had spent a lot of time on that sentence, and I was really doing my best with that sentence to be as honest as possible about something that was a little bit vulnerable. And she was saying, in a subtly, super subtly, at least I perceived it to be, maybe I'm inventing it, but my experience was that there was something a little bit judgmental about her toward the narrator, which in this case was kind of me. And I could feel my whole body tense up. It was manageable. I was still present. I was still able to hear what she was saying. I was able to repeat back what she was saying to make sure I understood it. I was able even to recognize that her intentions on the whole were good. She was genuinely trying to help me make this piece better. But because my ego is so incredibly attached to writing, and this section was a particularly vulnerable section, her critique of it triggered me. So that was a mild trigger. And then I'll share the biggest trigger that I have. Maybe I've healed it sufficiently that there's a bigger one that's waiting for me now. But this has been historically the most intense trigger of my whole life. I can shut down even to the point of blacking out if I experience myself as deeply disappointing a woman I care about a lot, especially in romantic relationships. I know some of you will relate to this. I will give an example. When I was dating an amazing woman named Lena about 7 or 8 years ago, we were circling the possibility of moving in together. She really wanted to, and I was ambivalent. After doing a lot of soul searching, I came to the conclusion that I was not ready to move in with her. I didn't want to break up with her. I still very much wanted to be in the relationship, but I could not yet move in with her. That was my scary truth. And it took me a lot of courage to tell her this. And I remember I got on the phone with her and I said, "Hey, I really think I need to find my own place in the East Village." And that is the last thing I remember until a minute or two later, where I came to on the sidewalk, somewhere between sitting down and laying down, like with my elbows on the concrete. It was so intense to feel her be so hurt by my decision that I couldn't live with her, that I literally blacked out. This is an extremely intense trigger rooted in very deep childhood trauma. So happy to share.
Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for being so vulnerable. It's as if a little bit of it is still in you when you tell the story. Is that true?
It doesn't quite feel like it's in me. It feels like I go back to that place. I channel the man that I was in that moment, in that story, in order to tell it. So that's why you're having the feeling that I'm being vulnerable, because that man who told Lena that was definitely extremely vulnerable. I really feel like I've claimed this trigger, worked through this trigger, and I'm happy to share it. And really, it feels really good to share something that is so intense and overwhelming, or has been so intense and overwhelming, because I know so many of us have these kinds of triggers and don't know how to talk about them, if we should talk about them, what they mean. They can be quite terrifying. So I feel just grateful to be able to share it.
Awesome. I guess there's two other things I wanted to talk about. One is that I've noticed in myself is that sometimes the intensity of the trigger will depend on the person that you're engaged with. So the same friend of ours that would not be punctual when we were going to the airport, when he and I would get into a conflict or a fight, my level of pain out of 1 to 10 would be at a 10. And it wouldn't be any more of a disagreement, or the conflict wouldn't be on the surface any bigger than a conflict that I would have with David or somebody else. But there was an intensity with him that I would experience that I haven't experienced with most of my friends when we would have a conflict. So it's just even noticing these kinds of things, the reactions that we have and the factors that make something more intense could be that it's literally the dynamics we might have with somebody and we can't really put our finger on. And in this case, I remember feeling really, really in a lot of pain, but also really confused about why I was in this level of pain because I couldn't understand it. So there are things like that, that if we're paying attention, we notice the impact on us from an emotional standpoint is different with one person than another. And then another example that we had used before, but I think it's a really common one that might be worth talking about, is in romantic relationships, when somebody doesn't communicate as frequently as the other person expects or prefers, and all the feelings that can cause and the stories that we might be telling ourselves, because I know that a lot of people find themselves in this situation, but they might not identify it as a trigger.
Yeah, what you're talking about in psychological terms would be anxious attachment, which is so many people, maybe a third of people. I don't know. That's a rough guess. And anxious attachment is when, in order to feel safe in a relationship, especially, but not necessarily exclusively, but especially in a romantic relationship, you need regular reassurance about the connection. If you don't get that regular reassurance, your anxiety can go through the roof. So let's say somebody doesn't give you that regular reassurance, or let's say you expect them to call you and they don't call you. And a third party can say very calmly, hey, he might have just forgotten. That doesn't mean he doesn't care about you. Sometimes you forget things too. It's perfectly normal. And we can have some perspective on it. But maybe for you, his not calling you gives rise to all sorts of catastrophic thoughts. Oh my God, he doesn't like me anymore. This is never going to work. We're breaking up. Should I break up with him? And this swirl of thoughts is originating in this profound anxiety. And this profound anxiety is almost certainly originating in childhood trauma. So this man's challenge in calling you that night is a trigger tapping into deep childhood trauma. This is so common.
I wanted to say one more thing that just came to mind, which is that sometimes when we have a reaction to something and it's super intense, and then on some level we are, oh my God, why am I having this reaction? What makes the experience even more intense is the shame that we feel from having that reaction to a seemingly weak stimuli. So it could be like, oh, this man that I went on 2 dates with didn't call me. And then I'll start getting really anxious and feeling insecure. And maybe he's going to cancel our date, whatever it is. And then we can catch ourselves feeling like everything might be at stake now. What's wrong with me? And then there is a feeling of shame that can intensify an already extremely uncomfortable emotional charge and reaction.
I think that's great. And I think that's a great transition to the question of what to do about these triggers. What you're describing is, I think, what a lot of us tend to do about these triggers. Probably the most common reaction we have when we recognize that we're having an overwhelming and intense emotional reaction to something, the most common reaction that we have is to try our very best to repress or ignore it. That's probably the most common reaction. The second most common reaction is to blame and shame ourselves. What the hell is wrong with us? This is what you're talking about, that we're having this reaction. So if you have an anxious attachment style, meaning you need constant reassurance to feel safe and secure in a relationship, and you don't get that reassurance, then you freak out and then you blame yourself for freaking out. Neither of these reactions or ways of coping with triggers are healthy. And we want to find a better way. And the better way starts with accepting that we are having this emotional reaction. And part of that acceptance means accepting that we have no choice whatsoever, no choice whatsoever in having this intense emotional reaction. When we are overcome by an intense reaction, intense emotional reaction, that is not something we are doing to ourselves. That is not a choice we are making. That is what is happening within our bodies. And the first thing I want us to learn to do, if we become conscious while we are having that reaction, is to do our best to accept that we are having the reaction. Then if we can, and sometimes we can't, but if we can, we want to try to soothe ourselves. Soothing ourselves can look something like this. Oh my God, I am freaking out right now because X. It's okay that I am freaking out. That is the reaction I'm having. As I'm talking right now, you can't see it, but I am putting my hand over my heart and I'm gently pressing down on my chest in a very soothing way. So I'm literally using my arm, my hand, to help calm me down, to help regulate me, to help soothe my nervous system. We can learn to do this for ourselves, and or we can help others to do it for us, or we can be with others who are capable of doing it for us. So if somebody is lucky enough to be in my presence when they are having an overwhelming or intense emotional experience, I will soothe them, sometimes merely by being present with them. My very presence and my attunement to their emotional reaction will calm them down, will help to regulate them. I want to repeat, though, sometimes we don't have any capacity to self-soothe, and we are just going to freak out. And it's going to take as long as it takes. And that's okay too. Most of the work of trying to deal with and heal from triggers will not happen while we are triggered. The trigger is an assignment for us to engage with what's really going on, but we can only do that assignment when we are not triggered. But I want to stop there and see if Avi has any more thoughts about how to cope with those moments when we really are triggered.
When you were just talking about the fact that the training happens not when we're triggered, it reminded me of an analogy that I think is really fitting. And it's the analogy of EMTs. There's an expectation that a high stakes, intense situation is going to happen, but the training has already been done. And so there's a level of preparedness when the situation happens. And then we do the best we can as an EMT to be able to help, but that point is too difficult to try to figure anything out except execute on what we know is likely to help us in that moment. But that most of the work has to happen before then, because we're not going to be in the space to do it when the trigger happens. And then the point that you made about sometimes we have no control, I think this is so important because on some level, those of us who even hear this don't actually believe it. Don't believe it about ourselves and don't believe it about other people. How can it be that we have absolutely no control about the way we're reacting to things? There are times I know that I've had no control. Realizing that this is true, really accepting this as truth, helps us be able to be there for other people when this happens, especially those people close to us, versus reacting to their reaction. Because I think sometimes we'll see someone reacting and instead of just taking a pause and thinking to ourselves, oh my gosh, this person is probably getting triggered right now, we might double down on how the reaction isn't proportionate to what might be happening. The acceptance in ourselves really helps us be able to be with other people when this is happening.
Yeah, I appreciate your appreciation of this thought. And I agree with you that it is something worth emphasizing. And it's also something we don't, our culture doesn't understand. So it's an obvious truth once you really wrap your mind. But until then, there's a lot of cultural pressure that pushes in the opposite direction. So I'll say it again with the hopes that it goes ever deeper into our bodies, into our nervous systems, and we can live from this place of knowing. We do not have control over the intense emotions that arise in us, period. We do not have control over the intense emotions that arise in us. When emotions get sufficiently intense, we may not even have control over our behavior. Sometimes, if we've become mindful enough about our emotions, we might be able to have more and more control even when we are having intense emotions. But if we haven't become mindful about our emotions, when they become intense, we will not have control over our behavior. I know that there is a lot out there that is about controlling our emotions, deciding what emotions to feel, focusing on the positive, willing ourselves to feel better. And there can be some truth in it. But whatever truth there is it is not as true or as powerful or as helpful, in my extremely educated and professional opinion, as orienting around the deeper truth that when emotions, intense emotions arise in us, they are not arising through choice. They are not arising through will. We should not strive to push them down or focus on other things. The work is to accept that we do not have control over these emotions that are arising within us. And from there, we can start to navigate our lives in healthier ways. I could probably say that. I'll probably say that about a million more times between now and when I die. It might be the most important thing I have to say on this earth. I don't know. It does feel pretty crucial.
I agree. And I also think the reason it's important is that it feels contrary to what most of us learn, especially as we're growing up, because when we start reacting, generally we're told to stop, or that's not appropriate, or whatever it is. So this message that whatever we're feeling is disproportionate to what's happening and that we're being a drama queen, it's something that's really deeply ingrained in us. So one, we judge ourselves, and then two, we judge other people for their reactions. And then the path back is really challenging because there's a lot of unlearning to do that we've integrated over years and years.
Totally. When some of you have heard the phrase trauma-informed, this is what we mean by trauma-informed. A trauma-informed work environment, a trauma-informed environment space, a trauma-informed world is a world where we collectively understand that the intense emotional reactions that are arising in people when stimuli seems to be trivial, but people are having intense emotional reactions, a trauma-informed world understands that the person having that reaction has no choice about that reaction. And thus, the correct and healthy response to somebody having an intense emotional reaction, if we have it within us to give naturally, is compassion. What people usually receive when they are having an intense emotional reaction to a seemingly trivial stimuli, what we are used to receiving is judgment. And judgment is not helpful or healing. Now, I want to make a key distinction, of course, between the feelings that are arising in us or the emotions that are arising in us and our behaviors. Let's say somebody says something to you. Let's say I'm late for an event that is really important to Avi. Avi has absolutely zero choice over the anger that will arise in her. None. It's going to happen. That is a trigger for Avi. The only way it will not be a trigger for Avi is if she works through the underlying trauma that is giving rise to that trigger, which she hasn't done yet through no fault of her own. It just hasn't happened yet on her healing journey. So now Avi's really, she has no choice about it. But then Avi turns to me and she says, "You're a bastard. I hate you." She may or may not have a choice about that behavior. It is possible that Avi has developed enough awareness to say to herself, I'm really angry. I have no choice about being this angry. But you know what? I'm going to be with my anger for now, and I'm not going to take out my anger on David, even though he was late. And that is something Avi might have a choice about. So the emotions that rise up, we are choiceless about. Our behavior in response to those emotions, we may or may not have a choice about, depending on how mindful we are around our emotions. So now we are at the fun part. What do we do about our triggers? We've talked about what to do when we are triggered, but what do we do about our triggers when we are not triggered? Let's say we're feeling really motivated to work through our triggers. We are recognizing that our triggers are opportunities for healing, and we want to do the healing. What now? First of all, the first thing I want to do is congratulate you. This is a huge step in the healing journey. The moment that you switch from judging yourself for having an intense emotional reaction to accepting that you're having an intense emotional reaction, and now you're getting curious about what to do about it from a place of self-compassion, that switch might be the most important switch you make in your whole healing journey. That might be the beginning of an incredible transformation. So one thing we want to do is we want to get curious about when we are getting triggered. What is triggering us? I've called this, and other people call this, stage trigger mapping. What is triggering me? When am I getting triggered? And maybe how intense is the trigger? So it took me a while to be able to see very specifically that I get really triggered, 10 out of 10 triggered, when I disappoint a woman I'm in a romantic relationship with. When she's extremely disappointed, I am extremely triggered. So that is really helpful. That's the first step. And then we'll talk about what to do about that after. But Avi, do you do some of that? I think you do.
First of all, everything that David just said is the reason that I think triggers are such precious gifts. They're asking us to look for where we need healing, and they're focusing our attention where it's really needed. And so to David's point, that is their gift. And so I want to thank my triggers. But yes, as I've been looking at the frequency of mine, the subtler and subtler ones, not just mine, I live with my sister. So we've been talking about this, a little bit of battling and a little bit of healing through some of it. The noticing of it without judgment has become life-altering. Everything has changed since we've been able to just even notice what might be happening.
I'm going to give you an example of
something that has been happening between me and my sister. And I know my sister won't mind me sharing this. The other day, the ice maker wasn't working or something a couple of weeks ago. And there was something about this ice maker that was not working that had her so distraught. It was really bad. I wasn't even sure there was anything wrong with it. It was making a noise. So she couldn't leave it alone. In the anxiety this was causing her, she did something to the fridge that even broke something else. So now she's in a really bad state. And we stayed with it for a while, and it was super intense. And then she was judging herself for what could be happening. And then as we've been talking through it and feeling through it, she realized that part of what happens when something small breaks down, especially in the house, is somehow it is threatening survival in a deepest way. If this fridge is not working, something really bad must be going on, and I need to fix it right away. It's urgent. It becomes urgent for her. And so just looking at what's happening has been really helpful for her. And sometimes, just in the noticing and in the pausing, the awareness has been helping the intensity of what's happening, because she's getting used to seeing that pattern. But what happened the other night was so cool. I was in my room and a glass broke. She was in the kitchen and she broke a glass. Normally, this would be like DEFCON 5. So as soon as I heard the glass, I ran into the living room because she's going to need help. So the cool thing about it was, one, I registered this as, oh my gosh, this could be a point of trigger for her. Let me go see if she needs any support. But when I got there, she was totally fine. And I was like, oh my God, I ran here because you broke this glass. And she's like, no, I'm fine. And I could feel that there was a part of that that was, I'm working through this trigger and I'm more aware of it. And when it happened, I was more okay. But then there was also the fact that I had come to support her instead of judge her for why she would get so crazy when a glass broke. That also made her feel held. And then she felt even better when I was there and she was even more calm. And just watching what that process has been with us over the last few months is so cool, because I remember me judging when she would be going crazy when a glass broke. And I remember her feeling really guilty about it afterwards. So just watching that transformation of me feeling compassion, the glass breaking, and her awareness and her feeling held by me caring about the fact that she might be getting triggered and showing up for support just changed everything for us.
That is a great story, Afi. I love that story. I'll tease out some of the themes of it because I think they'll help elucidate how to cope with your triggers or what to do about your triggers when you're not triggered. So many things went beautifully in the story. First, we got clear on what the trigger is. You got curious enough about the trigger to try to see what was underneath it. There's some sort of survival trauma waiting to be healed there. And then by virtue of becoming aware of it, something about the trigger relaxed a little bit. And then because you were together in this trigger, you were able to soothe her instead of judge her. And she was able to feel seen and held instead of judged and shamed. And all of that is allowing something that would have sent her spinning, dropping a glass. And instead, it's actually good that she dropped it because it's a moment of real connection and it shows how far you've come. So that's really powerful. So we're getting clear on what the trigger is. We're first communicating it to ourselves non-judgmentally. Then it's really awesome if we can communicate the trigger that we have to the people around us. So when I'm in a relationship, a romantic relationship, it's very important for me to tell whoever I'm with that, hey, if I disappoint you, I risk blacking out. It's really intense. And so then my partner can say to me, if she's being disappointed, something like, hey, I'm disappointed, but I'm still here in this with you. There's something about somebody, a woman being disappointed with me that triggers a very deep abandonment wound in me. So I can enlist my partner in helping me to soothe that abandonment wound instead of her just turning away from me as somebody might do naturally when they're disappointed in me. A healthy relationship, actually, I wonder if this is true. I'm about to say something radical that feels true. A healthy relationship is one that orients, where the people in the relationship orient around each other's triggers with compassion. A healthy relationship is one in which people orient around each other's triggers with compassion. An unhealthy relationship is one where people orient around each other's triggers with judgment. Now, sometimes, of course, triggers are going to trigger each other. We are going to get into what's called a trigger loop. This happens all the time between me and Avi. So Avi will say something to me, then I will react in such a way, being triggered, that will then in turn trigger Avi, and we will get into a circle. And it is very hard when you're in a trigger loop to orient around the other person's triggers with compassion because you yourself are triggered. So in that situation, you need to step outside of the trigger loop. And when you are calmer, try your best to figure out what's going on. It literally means saying, when I do this, you get triggered. When you do this, I get triggered. And on we go. And then we have a chance to interrupt the pattern. So the minute one of us gets triggered, we stop everything and we say, all right, let's engage with the fact that I or you are triggered right now. Do we want to talk about our trigger loops? Up to you.
So hard. I just think that's the area where I get stuck myself. Or we both get stuck because the example that I shared with my sister, although that's really challenging too, by the way, you guys, all of this is really challenging because we are so used to feeling ashamed about how we're feeling about things. But I find that being more aware of how we're feeling when at least I'm getting triggered has really helped me see the trigger and do all the things that David mentioned to basically neutralize as much as possible while it's happening, be able to respond in a way that feels a lot better to me, or at least know what's going on with me, or anticipate things in certain situations. With this trigger loop stuff, it's really challenging because that break that you get, that pause that you get when we notice a trigger fails to show up because you get in this loop where it intensifies indefinitely until there's some point where you're disengaged from this person or it takes it to a different level. And because both people are triggered, it feels impossible for us to even notice what's happening or be able to do anything about it. You said all fights are trigger loops. And I think that's so powerful. Can you imagine if we reframed fights as trigger loops? That could really help us look at them differently. So that's the reason I think it's important to talk about it, because we as people have a lot of fights. So having a deeper understanding at least of what's going on might be really helpful.
Yeah, the word all is a little problematic. I wonder if there are exceptions. I certainly feel comfortable saying the vast majority of fights are trigger loops. Probably go further and say the vast majority of wars are trigger loops. The vast majority of conflicts are trigger loops. We think we're fighting about what's right in front of us, what's happening right now, but what's actually happening is a wounded child in me is lashing out or defending himself against a wounded child in you. So if, let's say, I show up late to something with Avi, and then Avi gets really angry with me, and V starts expressing her anger. Now, let's say I feel, in response to her anger, defensive, and I say, Avi, you're upsetting me right now. But Avi is so angry that she can't be present to the fact that she's upsetting me. Now I'm triggered because one of my triggers is when I don't experience people attuning to my emotions, especially when I express them to people. So if I say I'm feeling sad right now and you ignore me or act like I didn't say it, then I get triggered. And so now Avi and I are in a fight. But what's really going on is her trigger and my trigger are butting heads with each other. So navigating trigger loops is among the most challenging things we can do in our lives, and definitely the most challenging things we can do in relationships. That's why I think couples so often benefit from therapy with third parties, is you get outside of these trigger loops and you try to see them for what they are. And then when you get back inside the relationship, when it comes up, you have that extra perspective. So the power of just mapping it, like you and I have been doing this recently, this is what's happening when I do, this is what's happening when you do this, and we get in this cycle. The power of mapping it allows you to see it when it's happening and then withdraw from the cycle and approach it when you're much calmer. When we're in the trigger loop, it's just going to be a mess. So our job is to accept that it's going to be a mess. So if you're triggered and I'm triggered and we haven't spent hours of our time trying to understand our triggers, trying to listen to our own emotions, trying to listen to the other person's emotions, and trying to communicate those emotions without blaming the other person for our experience, if we haven't done all that work, I totally understand. That work wasn't even available to us growing up. Nobody told us that was work we even should be doing. So maybe we didn't even know it was possible. If we haven't done that work, then it's just going to be a mess. And maybe All we can do is say to ourselves, when we are in this fight, when I'm not hearing you and you're not hearing me, maybe the best we can do is program a pause in advance. So we're going to say to each other, when we're in this kind of state, I'm going to withdraw, and then we'll come back to each other later. Sometimes that will be enough to get out. Now, for others, it actually won't work, because the thought of somebody withdrawing in the middle of the fight might send them spinning worse than anything. And so if that's the case, maybe there's nothing you can do and the energy just has to flow through and it's going to be a big freaking mess. And so be it. We're humans. We're allowed to make messes. And then after the fight, that's when we try to pick up the pieces and we try to understand, what did you do that brought up these intense emotions in me? What did I do that brought up these intense emotions in you? And what can we do to take care of each other so that those situations happen less often? And so that when they do happen, we can diffuse them sooner.
There's something, David, about understanding that I'm in a trigger loop with someone that's been really transformational for me, just the awareness of it, especially if there's a fight and things get really heated. Just the awareness that there are triggers at play allows me not to feel hopeless about the relationship foundationally. So before, if I was in a drag out fight with someone, I am triggered. David's trigger. We're just in this really.
We've had some good ones.
Yeah. We've had really good ones. Messy, ugly, intense situation. My default would be, fuck, this is not going to work out. This relationship is over. This is not something that we're going to come back from. And obviously that wasn't true because we didn't know any better. It couldn't have been helped. And I wasn't seeing it clearly. So the most empowering part, even if there's nothing I can do in that trigger loop when the fight is happening, its realization allows me not to associate doom and gloom foundationally with a relationship, but just understand this shit is intense. And once we take a little bit of time away from it, then we can see where we are, but I'm not already feeling defeated.
That's great, Avi. I just have a few last thoughts. I want to speak to your title here. I have two reasons why emotional triggers are such gifts. The first is that if we can learn to soothe ourselves, map out our triggers, help other people understand our triggers, and look upon our triggers with compassion, our lives will get so much better. It is a place of incredible leverage for our own growth and healing. It's like the tip of the healing iceberg popping out from the water. And if we can look at that and go, oh my God, here is an opportunity for me to really make a tremendous difference in my quality of life, that's what a trigger can be. The deeper reason, I don't know about my iceberg analogy. I don't know if that was the right one. So maybe toss that analogy, but everything else I said was good. The deeper reason why triggers are such precious gifts is because they point to and allow us to see our traumas. Triggers always point to traumas. And traumas, more than almost anything else, or on a par with anything else, control the way we react to the world, control the way we orient around in the world, control so much of our behavior. And so triggers are pointing at those parts of our unconscious that are running our show without our consent. If we can learn to work with our triggers with compassion, and only if we can learn to work with our triggers with compassion, then we have the opportunity to start working with our traumas with compassion. And when we start working with our traumas with compassion, then we are on track for the healing adventure of a lifetime. We now have an opportunity to transform into the person that we always were, but didn't always have access to. So I want to emphasize that piece that I threw into the middle of that sentence. So many people on the healing journey, or just so many people even not on the healing journey, when we discover that we have trauma and we discover that trauma is something that could possibly be healed, we often want to go immediately to heal the trauma. Like, oh, I've got this horrible thing that happened to me. I want to just get rid of it, or I don't want to be controlled by it anymore. Most of the time when we're in that state, we are actually not yet ready. We're not yet ready to heal the trauma. And the reason we're usually not ready to heal the trauma is because we haven't learned what attitude to take toward the trauma. The triggers show us the attitude we need to take in order to do the deep healing on our traumas. So the trauma, if we take, for example, that incredible trigger I have around disappointing women I'm in relationships with, actually black out. If I judge myself for that, if I say, what the hell is wrong with me? Then I'm not in a position yet to be present to the inner child or even to the baby within me who is so hurt and so abandoned that he had to check out from life completely in order to survive. I'm not ready to meet that child yet if I'm dismissive of the trigger. But if I can see, oh my God, this is so intense, this trigger, I need to learn to take care of myself here, then I am preparing myself to engage with the underlying trauma and indeed ultimately to heal it. So triggers are a training ground for the healing of trauma. That's why I believe they are precious gifts in disguise.
Yeah, thank you, David. That was really good. And I guess the only thing I want to say, because there isn't much to say after what you just said, is that if all we all get out of this room is just a deeper understanding and awareness of how often we are all triggered on a daily basis, and just become a little bit more aware when there's that rise, and then just become a little bit more aware of when these situations are happening and what might be causing them, and even be more welcoming to explore what might be going on with us with curiosity, I think we're so much better off. We're a humongous step towards understanding ourselves better and being able to support other people who are in relationships with better, and for them to be able to see us better. And the other thing that's been really helpful for me is that this understanding also helped me talk to friends or family, because it's not going to work when it's only one way. But when I have this information, then I can share it with the people that I love. And then when we get into sort of loops, or when I'm triggered or they're triggered, we're able to hold each other. That's been super transformational. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you for coming to our conversations. We hope to see you tomorrow in our room about anger. And if not there, then sometime soon. Have a beautiful afternoon, evening, morning, wherever you are in the world. And we will see you soon. Bye, everyone.